when you purchased an enslaved person, you were making a very serious financial investment. If you were a planter and you were to buy one, what's known as a prime number one field hand, you might be paying $1,500 in 1850s money, which is about $47,000 in today's money.
Erin Greenwald is an historian at the Historic New Orleans Collection, where she curated the exhibit Purchased Lives. A huge 1849 map of New Orleans dominates the exhibit's main room. Red dots indicate the over 50 locations where people were bought and sold in large numbers. Greenwald says other southern cities confine the slave trade to a single building or street. Not New Orleans.
New Orleans was completely saturated. You know, New Orleans is often discussed as being the queen city or the king city for cotton, and slavery and cotton go hand in hand. So it is a place where cotton is bought and sold and shipped to and shipped from, and the same is true of the slave trade here.
Enslaved people were sold in the middle of the business district, what's now the CBD. They were sold on boats, in French Quarter courtyards, and in the most sumptuous room of the most luxurious hotel in the South, the St. Louis Hotel, where the Omni Royal now stands. There's no plaque on the facade of today's hotel to let you know an auction block once existed there. In fact, New Orleans has very few physical markers commemorating this history.
People's tendency is to celebrate the past, and so it's harder to get, I think, a city to want to commemorate or recognize something negative from the past.
Part of the difficulty in acknowledging the extent of slavery's past is coming to terms with how much of our present has been shaped by it. Slavery amounted to breaking up families, and after the Civil War, people wanted to reunite with their sisters and fathers, but they often had no idea where to start looking, so they took a shot in the dark.
There's a series of newspapers that come online, mostly black newspapers, but also some that are affiliated with different churches. And in these newspapers, you see these advertisements being placed by people who are looking for family members who were separated from them during slavery. So mothers looking for children that they haven't seen in 30 years, don't even know what they look like. But people all over the country placed ads in the city of New Orleans on the off chance that their relative had been sold in the markets of New Orleans.
Dear editor, allow me space in your paper to inquire for my mother, Hannah McNear. The last time I saw her was in South Carolina. I was a small girl, about 10 years old, when I left her.
Dear editor,
I was brought to Mobile, Alabama.
I wish to inquire for my sister, Edna Millsap, who was carried to Louisiana in 1845 by John Millsap. She had two children, a boy and a girl.
Mr. Editor, I left my people in Greenville, Virginia about 30 years ago. My owner was McMilliam Wright. I was at that time taken away from my mother. Her name was Susan Allison. I had a brother, Edmund, a sister,
Dear
May,
editor,
and an uncle.
I wish to inquire for my father's people. They belong to Sam Shaggs of Maryland, 13 miles from Washington City. My father is Henderson Rideout. He was sold, ran off.
I wish to inquire for my sister whom I left in Monroe County, Mississippi. Her name
addressed me at New Orleans, Louisiana.
Dear editor, I wish to inquire for my mother, brother, and sister.
That's actors Pamela Davis Noland, Harold X. Evans, Sherry Marina, and Will Williams. Literacy was prohibited for many enslaved people, and so these advertisements were read aloud from the pulpits of over 500 churches across the South. For nearly 50 years after the Civil War, well into the 1900s, people continued to place these ads. Greenwald points to her favorite part of the exhibition.
This is a section that deals with all of the different industries that supported the trade. And so the banking industry and insurance companies, clothing manufacturers, these two coats are from Brooks Brothers of New York. One is a livery coat and one is a great coat worn by two enslaved men.
The coats hang on mannequins to remind us, says Greenwald, that even the clothing industry greased the wheels of slavery. But our governments also financially benefited. Greenwald points to an historic tax document which lists the names of people living in one block of the Treme who could be taxed.
And the assessor is going out, just like an assessor would now, and estimating the value of that person's property so that the city or parish can then tax that property. And the fifth person on this document is Filiette Richard, and she's got FWC after her name, which means free woman of color. She has a lot measuring 40.77 feet, and that lot and her home is valued at $1,250. And then she has four slaves who were valued at $2,450.
In other words, Richard's slaves were worth nearly twice as much as her land and her home combined.
So the more people one owned, the more taxes one would pay on those people.
That's exactly right.
So is it fair to say that the wealth of the city has been built in part through taxation on owning other human beings?
Absolutely. New Orleans in 1840 was the largest city in the South. It was the fourth largest city in the United States, and that was made possible by its role in the cotton industry, and you cannot have cotton to the extent that we had cotton in the United States without an enslaved labor force in that time period.
Greenwald says the exhibition tells a huge and difficult story, but she hopes people won't be too afraid or ashamed to come and understand our collective history. For WWNO and Louisiana Cultural Vistas, I'm Eve Abrams.